on 881. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. And thanks to everybody who pledged during our spring membership campaign. We really appreciate your interest and support. And now a conversation with Davon Love and Lawrence Grand Prix. They are African-American grassroots community activists who, along with Adam Jackson, lead an organization called Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. They are fixtures in Annapolis, advocating to the General Assembly on issues like police accountability and drug policy, and they have written a provocative book, a collection of essays that calls out the liberal white academic community and what they refer to as the nonprofit industrial complex for advancing institutional racism. It's called The Black Book, Reflections from the Baltimore Grassroots. Davon Love and Lawrence Grand Prix join me in the studio. Good morning. Good to see you guys.
Thanks for
having me. Good morning.
All right. So, Davon, tell us a little bit about Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, because this book comes from the experiences that you've had with this activist organization.
Absolutely. It's an organization that was founded, myself, Lawrence, Adam, and a few others, many of us former high school and college policy debaters. The idea was to take the expertise that you get from the activity policy debate and use those skills to advocate for the interest of people in Baltimore, particularly black folks, that oftentimes don't have institutions that are reflective of our communities, advancing our interest in the public policy arena. And so we've attacked issues like mass incarceration through stopping the construction of an $104 million juvenile detention facility in East Baltimore, things on reform in terms of police accountability. So those are the kinds of policy issues that we get involved in from the vantage point of using the skills that we get from policy debate to do advocacy in the public policy arena.
Mm-hmm. And Lawrence, you talk in the book about the importance of race literacy. Being racially literate. For a white person, what does that mean?
Specifically, what's unique about our book is that we take on people who think they're race literate and may have experiences with people of diverse backgrounds, but maybe don't understand the history and complexity that actually goes into having a functional engagement with race that can really produce the type of social justice outcomes that we seek. So my chapter stems largely from my experience going to our small liberal arts institution and working in the academy with liberal academics who maybe read a lot of postmodern sort of academic racial theory. When it came to their engagements with sort of African-American debaters who I was working with personally, they were using their own series and their own experiences and not the organic series and realities of the people they were engaging, and actually replicating a lot of the things that they think they were critical of. So the chapter goes very in-depth on lots of specific examples. Many very well-meaning individuals have use their series on race to engage people of color in ways that maybe aren't the most productive, and we advocate for actually sort of reading and engaging and theorizing from the material reality of oppressed people so you can have a more informed and more full understanding of inequality and racism.
And Davon Love, you talk about Pan-African nationalism and the importance, this is a theme that runs throughout the entire book, the importance of black people controlling the economic, social, and political institutions in black communities. At one point you say, let me be clear, we don't need white people. So talk about what Pan-African nationalism entails and the kinds of institution and institutional ownership that you're envisioning.
Well, I think a part of the problem with, like Lawrence was saying, many people's conceptions of what justice looks like, I think oftentimes omits the importance of black people to control our own institutions. So we think about other communities, you know, people see the end game as having the means of control of those institutions. And even when you think about, you know, revolutionary movements around the world in terms, you know, think about the post-colonial period, you know, and the rise of nations around the world gaining their independence from colonialism, you know, the conversation around self-determination was a discourse, was a concept that was highly fashionable. But for some reason, when it comes to people of African descent, the idea of black folks controlling institutions seems like this scary idea, right? And so the point that I try to make in the book is I think many people have been socialized to see the idea of black folks demanding that we control our institutions as somehow antagonistic to other people, as if to advocate for one's own institutional capacity is to be off-putting to other folks and other issues of justice. And so the notion of Pan-African nationalism, as it's articulated in the book, is the idea that people of African descent have a long legacy before, you know, chattel slavery, all the way back to, you know, talking about the ancient Nile Valley civilizations. of being able to erect institutions, to be able to engage in social change. There's a long legacy of that. And I think we need to begin to use the intellectual and cultural resources of African descended people, particularly if we're talking about problems that deal with primarily African descended people.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of the kinds of institutions you're talking about. I mean, you do talk a lot about this nonprofit industrial complex. So you're talking about the nonprofit world, you're talking about the for-profit world, we're talking about banks, we're talking about companies. What are we talking about?
Examples. You talk about like independent schools, you know, that provide the kind of education to socialize African descended people and understanding the larger social context. We're talking about, you know, credit unions, you know, financial institutions where people of the community have collective ownership. They have greater access to loans that they get low interest. So, you know, these are the kinds of things, just examples of things that not only are just thought experiments, but they're historical examples of where this has happened, where these type of institutions have been built that have created some of the change that we talk about in the book.
Davon Love and Lawrence Grand Prix are the authors of the essays collected in The Black Book, Reflections from the Baltimore Grassroots. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lawrence, you mentioned in this book, you and Davon in each of your essays, that white liberals like to say that issues of inequality are based in class and they're not based in race. But you say that's a specious argument. How come?
It's an incomplete argument. The first chapter in the book is called Anti-Blackness as the Independent Political System, and it argues that if you just look materially at the data, the reality of inequality in this country cannot be explained strictly through class. So, for example, Robert Bullard is a professor who does work on environmental racism, and he says that it's race, not class, that most clearly correlates into environmental inequalities. Similarly, the chapter goes very in-depth on medical racism, which even when you control for class, black people get disproportionate treatment even when they have health insurance. So you're looking at things like black people being prescribed less pain medication, and the argument from different theorists is that there's a subconscious fear on the part of the doctor, well, this person could get hooked on drugs, or this person has a higher pain tolerance. Both of those ideas, the book argues, come from a legacy of slavery in terms of the black body having a higher pain tolerance and potentially can go out of control. So even when you control for class, you can't account for what's happening in terms of the material outcomes in society. And the last thing I'll say is that if you look at things like the Affordable Care Act, you have the federal government giving away free money to states, yet they choose to reject it because they got a political benefit from turning against the president. And we argue that can't be seen outside of the context of, well, the president happens to be black. And you can't understand that strictly through the lens of class because the majority of people who would have benefited from those programs would have been poor white folks.
Mm-hmm. So that's a racial decision on the part of those governors who made the decision to turn down the
Charles Mills, a professor at Northwestern, has a very clear argument in terms of the racial contract. And if you look at the history of class connections between poor whites and poor blacks, he argues in theory that poor whites would choose the pleasure and value of whiteness as a material feeling and phenomenon over the material benefits they would get from connecting with black people. And you can see this in practice through the history of racism in unions, when even today, when you have unions wanting to come together, they have issues connecting the so-called proletariat because of racial divisions. And as the book goes in depth, you have clear examples where people are choosing this sort of sense of pleasure that they get from what Charles Mills calls whiteness. And we're just applying his theories into more specific instances in places like Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. So you talk both about the academy and this nonprofit industrial complex. And in general, you talk about white liberals and even folks who are supposedly on the same team, as it were. You say that folks can be simultaneously against white supremacy, but for anti-blackness. Mm-hmm. So, Davon Love, what do you mean by that?
So one of the things about many of the theorists, like Lawrence talked about, many of the post-structuralist, postmodern theorists that talk about social change, there's often an obsession with a critique of power, right? So that we have to challenge the way that power is manifesting in society. One of the problems with that is that the obsession, and not that we should resist the, you know, larger institutions of power, but the problem is that what happens is that the notion of building power oftentimes gets understood as participating in the same kind of sociological forces that create inequality, right? The idea of black folks, for instance, in this case, having to develop institutions of power. So what happens is that you'll have folks who talk about the importance of challenging white supremacy as a larger structure and system and the power that it wields over, you know, our society. It is an organizing principle of civil society. But what happens is when it comes to black folks organizing on our own terms, being in control of our institutions, you'll have white folks, you know, folks of really of many different, of any race, who will make the argument that the idea of black institutional development and developing capacity would be incorporating into the larger structure of society, therefore not having fidelity to this legacy of resisting power. And so I think it is that level of abstraction that creates this context where just the concrete needs of developing power gets obscured. And so I mean, and there are people who are freaked out. I mean, if you think about the idea of what people have grafted onto notions of Pan-African nationalism or black nationalism, there's a certain kind of emotive trigger that gets triggered. And what that demonstrates is that the idea of black folks having power is something that even the most liberal, progressive, political allies sometimes struggle with the idea
of. It's a threat to everybody.
Exactly.
Well, Lawrence Graham Peterson, what is the role for white people? I mean, people who want to say, you know, there are a bunch of white folks listening to this right now saying, you know, we're for equality. We're for equal opportunity. Mm-hmm. We're for all the things that the black community is for. So what is the role? I mean, at one point you just basically say stand out of the way and let black folks have control of these institutions. I think there's a point to be made about, you know, the inequality when it comes to those things. We talk about the people who serve on boards of directors and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But what is the role succinctly for white folks who want to help?
That's a complex question. I'll try to use some specific examples. So one thing is that I think white folks need to really engage with the material history of independent black scholars throughout the pantheon and history of the black political intellectual tradition. Because one thing that I think I see consistently is that a white advocate say, I'm for equality, but then they support programs that maybe produce like a white savior narrative. And that becomes their definition of equality because that's what they've internalized. And they can't see the material differences between a black-led program, which has a social justice component that's organic to the cultural reality of the community, and a black-led program that isn't that. So this isn't a racial essentialism argument. We're not saying all black-led programs are good and all white-led programs are bad. We're saying there's a cultural and political reality that requires you to have a respectful and material engagement with things like the white savior reality.
And Davon, you say in the book that liking black people isn't racial justice.
Right,
and
exactly.
And that people's personal evolutions of, you know, I got friends who are black, that whole thing, that's not racial justice. But if not personal evolutions by a whole bunch of individual people, then how does racial justice get achieved?
Well, I think we have to think about it on the scale of the institutions in our society. I think oftentimes what happens is when people talk about the idea of independent black institutions, people think that that means that, you know, I can't have any white friends, so we need to isolate ourselves from all of society. And, you know, if you think about other communities, you know, you have independent communities, you know, that have relationships with larger civil society, but have the institutions to protect their interests. And so what social justice looks like is the capacity for each group to be able to marshal the institutions of civil society to protect its interests. In the case that we see in our society where, as black folks are concerned, that historically and contemporaneously, we live in a society that will not ensure that the needs of our community are met. So we need to be able to do it on our own terms. And so, and just quickly to your last question, to just add to what Lawrence said, when you think about the role that white people should play, it's the role that anybody would play in a helpful capacity in trying to help anyone else achieve a particular goal. You know, if you go to someone and say, well, what can I do to help? You take their direction. Unfortunately, what happens in our communities is people come in and think that they can prescribe to us, you know, how to fix our communities. And that's the problem, and that's the thing we try to outline in the book.
Well, you guys give a lot of folks on both sides of the political spectrum a lot to think about in this book. I appreciate the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Davon Love and Lawrence Graham Prix, their collection of essays is called The Black Book, Reflections from the Baltimore Grassroots. You can get it by going to the Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll give you the link. On 88.1, you're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. Lots more coming up after the news, but first, it's time now for The Environment in Focus with Tom Pelton.